Hello and welcome to Practical Cardiology. I'm Patrick Campbell, Senior Editor of Practical Cardiology, and I will be your host for this episode. This episode of Practical Cardiology features Robert L. Page, PharmD, a professor of clinical pharmacy at the University of Colorado Skaggs School of Pharmacy and Pharmaceutical Sciences. Dr. Page is also the co-author of a recent scientific statement from the American Heart Association describing the state of understanding regarding marijuana and its effect on cardiovascular health. Page describes the statement as a call to action for more research into the effects of marijuana in both medicinal and recreational settings on overall, but specifically cardiovascular health, as legalization seems to become more commonplace and less of a rarity. The statement also outlines the increased risk of cardiovascular complications seen with marijuana use in observational studies, but then goes on to highlight the lack of prospective studies we've seen examining the issue due to marijuana Schedule I status. Practicing in Colorado, Page speaks from a research background and anecdotally from his own personal experience as he discusses the impact he has seen marijuana legalization have on cardiovascular health at a population level. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Dr. Page.
Again, thank you so much for having me on for today. My name is Robert Page. I am a professor at the University of Colorado School of Pharmacy and School of Medicine, and a clinical pharmacy specialist with the Division of Cardiology. And basically, my practice area is primarily within the areas of advanced heart failure and transplant. But again, because of the place that I live in, I've become my research now is focused in on cannabis science.
All right, thank you for that. And that was actually going to be one of my questions, is sort of how you got into this, because it is an area that has been under-researched across many different aspects of medicine, not just in cardiology. So when we look at this new scientific statement from the American Heart Association, just at a glance, what would you want the biggest takeaways to be for practicing cardiologists who may have had trouble finding an overview of the effects of THC, CBD, medical cannabis, and medical marijuana, and recreational marijuana
in the thyroid? Well, this is a good question. First and foremost, is the one thing I would say is trying to get patients to be first transparent with their use. I think is very, very, very important. And then number two, in terms of for practicing cardiologists, you know, one of the things that I have run into, at least over since the legalization here in the state of Colorado, is that patients believe because it's natural, then it must be safe. And so honestly, that's a misconception. Cannabis is like any other drug medication. It carries sometimes significant side effects. And this is an evolving story, and it's actually a moving target as more and more data continue to come out. And so what my hope is with regard to this clinical science statement is to make both cardiologists, primary care docs, to understand the fact that even based upon observational data, there are some red flags. That and some signals that need to be taken into account with regards to increased incidence with regards to cardiovascular diseases such as coronary syndrome, heart failure, stroke, and arrhythmias. And so it's an important point that we want to get out there.
Okay, thank you for that. And now there's a lot of different data that you guys go over. This is definitely one of the more comprehensive statements that I've seen from the AHA recently. Let me ask you, I know it's been Schedule I the entire time, but how has the legalization push we've seen in the US and also in Canada impacted research? Have we seen an increase in research, or is it still an area that needs to be addressed?
This is one of the other things that I'm really happy that the American Heart Association has supported, is the fact that we definitely have to have research in this area. I can say that in terms of legal requirements, they really have not changed. In fact, it's literally to get protocol through the IRB, you've got like this much paperwork to get through. And also you can only get a product from certain places within the United States. So it's research is pretty, it's still pretty strenuous. We do have a few studies ongoing on campus evaluating the effects of oral cannabis with regards to PTSD, depression. There's some studies going on with regards to seizure disorder. And again, within those contexts, we will be capturing, or the investigators will be capturing adverse events as well. But unfortunately, we really have been limited to observational data because that's, and again, being in a state where this is very, very, very prevalent, you know, we're able to at least do that. But unfortunately, with observational data, you know, you can only show an association and not so much causation when it comes to adverse events. And so we, this statement is a call to action to say, guys, we need to have data with regards to this to in order to evaluate it. So my hope is down the road, this will be changed from the Schedule One, which again, that's where like LSD is actually put into that. So meaning, again, a Schedule One means high abuse potential, no therapeutic benefit, and a very large amount of adverse events that can occur. And I don't know if I agree. I don't really agree with that. So,
okay, thank you for that. And now, when we look at sort of the way different things are researched, it usually depends on the popularity, the push that we get for research. And we haven't necessarily, as you stated then, seen that with medical marijuana as much on a long or large term scale. How far behind has that left us in comparison to what we know about other things? It seems like smoking in general, we had a really big push for to learn about that. Seems like we know a lot about the effects of alcohol, but even still, how far behind has that left us? And is this really as unique as it seems?
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting. If you look back into the 1950s, we even had physicians advertising cigarettes saying this is the safe cigarette. And now, of course, now I look back on that 50 years more later and realize, oh my gosh, we were so wrong. I feel like in the case of vaping, we're finally getting caught up in terms of research with regards to that. But in terms of marijuana, we are, or cannabis, we might as well be back into the 1960s again, because we just don't really have a large amount of data. The other point I want to bring up is the fact that the cannabis that's being used nowadays is not your granddaddy's marijuana from the 60s. The issue is that it's got a significant amount of THC and CBD in it, which is much different than what you would have seen in the 50s and the 60s. So, and again, we don't, a large number of the studies that have been currently published, these observational studies, are using, you know, first generation cannabis products and not the second generation that patients are maybe using.
Okay, thank you for that. And now, as we look at, you touched a little bit on there, there's a lot of information that comes out. It's mostly observational. Is there any significant differences you think that clinicians should keep in mind for patients that may be using CBD products as opposed to THC or regular cannabis products?
So at this point in time, the one thing I would say is I get asked this question a lot because there are some CBD products that are you can buy in a pharmacy. The one thing I would say is buyer beware. I know that the FDA has found that when they did evaluate a few of these products, they didn't even contain CBD in them. So, you know, and these products are expensive. They can be up to like $60 or more. The other thing too is particularly, again, you can only get over the counter, the topical formulations. And I think that the problem that exists there is the fact, again, CBD binds primarily to, one of the specific subtype receptors, which actually may have some theoretical benefit. It doesn't interact with the ones that elicit some of the cardiovascular effects. Where I run into this problem is the fact that CBD is a very potent inhibitor of cytochrome P450 3A4. And again, 60% of the medications that are on the market go through that enzyme system. So there is a significant potential for drug-drug interactions, even with the topical. Now, so that's, and again, if you're buying something over the counter in a pharmacy, not in a dispensary, again, I always say buyer beware, because you don't really know. Remember, these are not regulated. You have to treat these just like any other natural or herbal supplement. The ones in the dispensaries, I will say again, can contain some THC, even though they may say that they only have CBD in them. Again, these are still not regulated. They're not regulated. You really don't know exactly how much of the CBD is within the product. And again, these aren't cheap. One of the things I got permission from my dean in order to evaluate some of these dispensaries and to see what products are out there. And so I very much so have been able to see what's out there within these dispensaries. And also when I was, you know, within Canada giving a talk, I actually went into a few of those dispensaries. And the ones on the West Coast. And so it is interesting to know that the variety of products that are out there, and they run anywhere between $20 to $60 for a tube. So it's, again, these are not cheap. And they're not regulated. That's another thing that we put in our clinical science statement. It would be nice if we had some regulation.
Yeah, I definitely think that would be helpful. Now, let me ask you for your perspective. I've spoke to some cardiologists in the past, and when I asked them about the future of cardiovascular health, a few of them have mentioned before that they think cannabis use and the sort of normalization of that is something that we're going to regret in the future as we learn more about the way it impacts cardiovascular health. Is that a justified feeling as of right now, or is that a little bit of an extreme reaction?
That's actually a really good point. I think we're too early in the story to truly state. Now, in terms of smoking cannabis, absolutely there are problems there, because the carcinogens that are found within cigarette smoke are very similar to what is also found within cannabis. And the second thing too, I've had some patients say, well, I'm gonna vape, that must be safer. No, it's absolutely not safe. In fact, it may contain this vitamin E solute, which has been also associated with lung injury. So in terms of smoking cannabis, my opinion is the fact, absolutely not. I think that we're not jumping the gun on that, that there are hazards definitely associated with that, in particularly cardiovascular, because we do know the acute effects from smoking it in terms of hypotension, tachycardia, and if you have underlying cardiovascular conditions, this can possibly exacerbate that. When it comes to the edibles, I think we're still too early in the story to know. Until we have some of these prospective studies, there are some, again, there's no really documented cardiovascular benefits out there with regards to oral cannabis. There's a lot of theoretical potential benefits in terms of maybe some antioxidants, some anti-atherosclerotic effects, but that's all, it's all hypothetical. So I don't know, we're at this point, and I think that the cardiologists should be hesitant still. They need, that's the reason why, and I'm kind of glad to hear that, because we hear a lot of the benefits, but we also need to understand the risks. And again, the observational data that's published, that does show some red flags. And but again, I think this is an evolving story. And again, data come out, I get information almost every day with regards to things that are new and recently published. And so again, I would just stay tuned.
Okay, and now as we look forward to those prospective studies that hopefully will be in the works soon, the reality is we won't be able to learn everything we want to about this all at once. What do you think are the most important topics that need to be addressed once these prospective studies actually get rolling?
Well, one of the things too is with regards to safety within some of our vulnerable populations. I can say here, particularly in Colorado, since this COVID crisis, again, we had what's called, when we had the initial shutdown, the only two places, three places that really weren't shut down was alcohol, grocery stores, but also pot shops. And so we've seen a huge uptick, especially during this time period, with regards to cannabis use, and particularly within 17-year-olds and higher, also a very large uptick within very young adults. And so we need to be able to explore some of the risks that are associated, the benefits, but also, again, the risks within these vulnerable populations. We've seen an uptick, actually, believe it or not, within the geriatric population. And realize, again, they have at least 5 or more chronic conditions, take at least, in some cases, 10 or more medications where there are a lot of potential for drug-drug interactions to exist. So we need to be looking at those. We have very limited data when it comes to pregnancy and also within the transplant population as well. I can say, because I deal in heart transplant, that and we have some data to support this, that we've actually seen significant drug-drug interactions with our immunosuppressants, particularly our CNI drugs. And that's the reason why we really have to say, you know, you can't be using, smoking, or any form of cannabis and being considered for heart transplant. So these are some of the questions that need to be addressed. But again, two things have to happen. Schedule one has to go, and number two is we need some regulation on the product, because we need to know exactly the amount of THC and CBD in these products. Right now, there's a guesstimate based upon the label if someone buys it from a dispensary, but even then, there's been data to support that it's highly variable. There's huge variations within these products. So again, there are a few things that have to happen first before we can move forward with this.
Okay, and just lastly, you point out in your scientific statement, I think it's just over 24 studies related to sort of observational data about marijuana use and heart health. Are there any studies in particular that stand out to you that you think clinicians, if they only have time to check out 5 studies this week, what would they be from this?
Right, that's a good point. You know, one of the nice things, and this was put together also by Dr. Kloner, who is also an expert in the area of toxicology and cannabis. And the cardia studies are the ones that probably, again, are the ones that provide the most information with regards to, in terms of the impact on population health. They're some of the largest, but we intentionally created a table in the clinical science statement that summarizes it all, because people don't have time to pull all these data. And so, and it's get straight to the point. It's going to give you your hazard ratio and your relative risk. But again, one of the caveats, and we do highlight the limitations, is this observational data. When you're dealing with observation, you're dealing with association sometimes and not causation. And the other problem with a large number of those studies is some of these patients were also smoking cigarettes concomitantly as well. So it makes it kind of muddies the water. But I think, and I really do, I'm very excited that the AHA, though, said, you know what, we need at least a starting point. We need to know where the science is at this point in time so we know how to go forward. And again, this is an evolving story that will continue to evolve for the better or for the worst. But nonetheless, again, I would refer clinicians, honestly, to that table. One page, and it's right there. And in particular, it's some of the cardia studies that use some of the largest data sets that were available at the time.
All right, that was about it on my questions. Was there anything else you wanted to add about the statement or sort of the call for research or the change to the Schedule I status of the substance?
You know, the other thing too, again, as a professor and as an educator at all levels of health science students, I think it's very important that we educate ourselves with regards to cannabis. I can say, like here within the School of Pharmacy, we now have a whole course in it. But if you ask a large number, like when I talk to my medical residents, cardiology fellows, they're like, I didn't get any of that training in medical school. So I think finding appropriate resources in order to better educate, this clinical science statement is actually one step towards that. I get asked this question with regards to where can I find information. There are numerous certificate programs also across the country. We have one here at the University of Colorado, not plugging it, but we do have one here in cannabis science, and also the University of Maryland has one as well. They actually have a master's program. Nonetheless, I think providers, before they, you know, you want to judge, you got to be open-minded, and you also need to educate yourself on the science of it. And again, that's one of the things I salute the American Heart Association for taking this, because this is a controversial topic. It really, really is.
All right. That was about it on my questions. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me today, Dr. Page.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's it for this episode of Practical Cardiology. I'm Patrick Campbell. Thanks for listening.